ash, bone, and sickle. Bleeding saints and forest witches, the past unburied, the books unsealed, the old celebration returning.
Hello, and welcome to my study. Please come in and have a seat. All the books surrounding you are those used to research our show, and the individual to my right here, along with managing domestic duties, serves as our reader for any passages that will be directly quoted from these sources. Her name is Mrs. Carswell.
Hello.
So, before we get into our show proper, I've promised Mrs. Carswell that she can read a letter on the air.
Yes, and it's very much appreciated.
And the letter is not written by an owl or any member of the bird family.
No.
We had some very strong differences of opinion about the letter purportedly authored by my pet owl Strix, the show before last, and as a way of smoothing that over, I've agreed to give some time over for another of Mrs. Carswell's letters this time around.
Not my letter, though.
Yes, I realize it's from a listener.
It's from Sarah Chavez.
Sarah Chavez.
Yes.
Who is a listener to the show?
Well, I think she may listen. I mean, she's certainly familiar with the show.
Well, not exactly a fan. Maybe she listens, maybe she doesn't, but somehow it's very important to read her letter. I mean, how do you even know this person?
It's kind of hard to explain.
Which makes it hard for me to understand.
I guess you could say she's a special friend.
This is all making me a little uncomfortable. I'm not...
I don't mean...
No, it's fine. It's just that something feels...
It's a real book. I showed you the copy she sent. She's a real person.
What a strange thing to say.
It's called We Need to Talk About Death, an important book about grief, celebrations, and love. And you can find it on Amazon or at your local bookstore. Can I read you what she wrote? The blurb.
The letter.
Well, it's more of a blurb, but she sent it in a letter for me to read.
Just read it.
Kids' natural curiosity and questions about death are often met with silence and uncertainty because the adults around them don't have the answers. We Need to Talk About Death is full of all the facts, science, and history that make death such a fascinating subject. While important questions like, what is death, and what happens to a dead body are answered, Bone and Sickle listeners will especially appreciate all the strange and fascinating chapters on things like magical corpses, festivals and rituals that honor the dead, and supernatural objects that have been buried with the dead, a look at funerary rituals around the world, and much more.
Okay, well, I can imagine listeners wanting to check this out, especially if they have kids, but that doesn't mean we're going to start plugging every book or project that gets sent in.
No, it's just that this is a special case.
A special real book. A real book written by a real person.
Yes.
Okay, so no need to question reality then. We'll start the episode. This one is episode 128, The Mesmerist. I am your host, Al Ridenour, and this show, Bone and Sickle, examines the intertwining of horror and folklore in a historical context. I started the show as a way to further explore this area of intersection after writing my book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, and will have a related volume out at the start of next year. Bone and Sickle only exists thanks to the generosity of our Patreon donors, who choose from a tantalizing array of monthly rewards, including shirts, mugs, dusty old things from the library shelves here, and access to monthly bonus episodes. And I'll have more on all that at the end of our show.
Shall see nothing, hear nothing, dream of nothing, but Svengali, Svengali, Svengali,
Svengali, Svengali. Svengali.
Yeah.
What'd he do?
He hypnotized you.
Hey, and don't you ever let him do it again. Those fellas can make you do anything and say anything you want. Lie, steal, anything.
And then they make you kill yourself when they're done with you.
Hey, they do that.
But he took my pain away.
I'd rather have the pain than have it cured like that.
That's from the 1931 film Svengali with John Barrymore in the title role. Even listeners more acquainted with Svengali than the Svengali story will still, I'm sure, have some idea what a Svengali is, as the name's been generalized to designate any sort of masterfully controlling character, or particularly one responsible for another's success. In the film, Barrymore plays an Eastern European musician of middling talent who works as a voice coach for a young woman, one with whom he is in love. Though the romantic connection goes unrealized, his previously tone-deaf protege surprisingly rises to singing stardom through the power of Svengali's hypnotic control. The 1931 film is hardly the first to be adapted from a novel written in 1894 by British writer Georges du Maurier. There had been silent versions aplenty in 1912, 1915, 1923, and 1927, along with a few adaptations after Barrymore's film, one in 1954 and a 1983 version with Peter O'Toole in the title role. But the 1931 version remains the most remembered. Barrymore, who originally hoped to add a comic dimension to the character, doesn't exactly do that, though there's a certain cloyingly ingratiating quality to his Svengali, albeit a bit hard to see under his makeup and what's probably the pointiest beard ever worn in a film. For good or ill, it's very much work of its day, which also means the production design is tinged with that same German expressionism found in Dracula and Frankenstein, two other films released that same year. There's a particularly impressive sequence representing Svengali's telepathic control of his subject at a distance, one featuring a camera sweeping over a miniature version of the city, looking more like a grotesquely off-kilter medieval Prague than 19th century Paris, where the story is set. Du Maurier's novel, one of the most commercially successful of the 19th century, is not named for the hypnotist Svengali, but for the singer. It's called Trilby, after Trilby O'Farrell, an Irish girl working as a model in a British artist's colony in Paris. While Svengali went on to become a figure of speech, Trilby's bohemian lifestyle also contributed to the public's fascination with the story. The novel was immediately adapted as a play, a musical, and comic opera. It found its way into newspaper cartoons, music hall sketches, and even theme parties of the era. Trilby's uniquely bohemian personal style, as described in the novel, was all the rage, including the men's military-style jacket she donned, also her tomboyish hat, a sort of narrow-brimmed fedora, a style later popularized by Frank Sinatra and still known as a trilby. But Trilby Mania, or Tribbliana as it was dubbed at the time, didn't stop there. There was trilby-themed jewelry, cufflinks, shoes, dolls, toys, gumdrops, candies, ice cream bars, and even sausages. Another influence the novel had was on the French author Gaston Leroux, whose 1909 novel, The Phantom of the Opera, gives us another musical protege under sinister control. Trilby, published only 3 years before Dracula, would have certainly also been on Bram Stoker's radar and may have offered some inspiration to his own descriptions of young women, also under the hypnotic control of a mysterious Eastern European, albeit not identified as a Jew, as in Du Maurier's uncomfortably emphatic characterizations. The two classic 1931 films adapting these books not only partake in the same German expressionistic design style, but also provided similar visual treatment of the title character's eyes, with both Lugosi and Barrymore famously portrayed in shadowy close-ups with eyes highlighted with pen lights, though Barrymore goes one better, donning the first contact lenses worn in Hollywood as a special effect for several shots in which his eyes go entirely white.
Look into my eyes. Look.
Now look into my eyes.
You will sleep.
Now do not take your eyes away.
Look. Sleep into my eyes.
Now you are going.
What a lovely young lady.
Nothing else.
When you wake,
sleep.
The pain will be gone.
Everything
else
is darkness.
This is my voice. Your will is leaving you.
I do feel very tired.
Although your eyes are open, and you seem aware, you are in fact asleep. Your faculties dormant. Your ability to act and think subservient to my will.
I had considered dedicating this episode to a survey of hypnosis in Victorian and later horror literature, but I settled instead on a quick sound collage, as you can hear. We will probably do a hypnosis-related horror story on our Patreon as a bonus episode, and I have other content of that nature to share. But meanwhile, I've decided to focus on where it all began with the fascinating and rather weird story of the 18th century German doctor, Franz Anton Mesmer, after whom mesmerism is named. I'm equating mesmerism here with the modern term hypnotism, but you'll hear how the approach to it all was rather different in the beginning.
To experience the sensation of hypnosis, to cross the dark, mysterious threshold of your own unconscious mind. And now, if you dare, look into the hypnotic eye.
An ambitious son of a master forester in a Swabian village on the shores of Lake Constance, Mesmer hoped to pursue a career as a physician, ending up studying under the Jesuits at the University of Dillingen and Ingolstadt, Dr. Frankenstein's old alma mater, before relocating to the University of Vienna, where in 1766 he submitted a dissertation entitled On the Influence of the Planets on the Human Body. Inspired by Isaac Newton's theory of the tides, Mesmer had begun to think of the human body and mind as immersed and permeated by an invisible dynamic fluid, one moving in a way comparable to the moon's gravitational pull upon the tides. The latter was referred to at the time as planetary or cosmic magnetism, to distinguish it from the mineral magnetism, that of a lodestone attracting metals. A version of this force, particularly affecting human beings, Mesmer referred to as
animal magnetism.
Now, this isn't to be understood as bestial or having anything to do with raw sex appeal, as the term's casually used today. It's from the Latin word animus, designating the animating principle, the mind, spirit, or life within all creatures that walk, fly, swim, or think too much. Mesmer's thinking was very tied to the Enlightenment ethos in that it recast religious discussions of the soul into a scientific framework where it might be considered alongside properties of the natural world, including tides, gravity, and magnetism. But there was also this anti-Enlightenment aspect, the crisis, as it was called, something Mesmer deemed essential for his magnetic healings. And this crisis could be rather unsightly, but more on that later. Mesmer's philosophy, or mesmerism, though that's not the term he or others used until 1814, a year before his death. Anyway, Mesmer's way of thinking about the healthy individual was analogous to a well-functioning water mill. A jam within the system, keeping the mill from its proper function, would need to be unjammed, or shaken loose through a crisis, or the application of an outside magnetic force by the physician magnetizer. This outside influence was only possible in a trance state or magnetic sleep, during which individual control was ceded to the flow of the vital substance as directed by the therapist. Behavior during these trance episodes, as it turned out, did not exactly epitomize Enlightenment ideals. It did, however, clearly anticipate later clinical psychology's preoccupation with cures through induced crises, through the release of emotions and the uncovering of difficult psychological material. Oh, I hope this is all making sense to you. I don't know how it could. These theories were not all at once articulated. In fact, it may have been something just systemized after the fact. Mesmer's theories did not immediately arise from or proceed into practice. There are questions and gaps in his biography, the whole of which, the more you look at it, takes on the feeling of one big theatrical improvisation. Trying to put it all together, from the date of his dissertation, we know that he did not leave school till the ripe old age of 32. It also turns out that much of this dissertation was directly plagiarized from a physician friend of Isaac Newton, namely Richard Mead's work on the rule of the sun and the moon over human bodies and diseases arising from them. 2 years after submitting his plagiarized thesis, Mesmer married a wealthy widow, Anna Maria von Posch, whom he would later abandon once he'd moved to Paris and engaged a bevy of wealthy clients there. Even the notion of magnetic healing was not originally his. At the age of 40, Mesmer became acquainted with Maximilian Hell, a Hungarian Jesuit and astronomer then living in Vienna. After witnessing and collaborating in some of his magnetic treatments, Mesmer borrowed the idea, possibly even the very magnets, for his own experiments, apparently making no real distinction at the time between mineral magnets and the animal magnetism with which his work would become identified. While Mesmer would at various points declare the common magnet as unnecessary to the direction of animal magnetism, they still showed up in accounts at later dates, which is the sort of thing I mean when I refer to his career as a sort of loose improvisation. Mesmer's first documented therapeutic success occurred that same year in 1774 when he induced an ailing young woman in his social circle, Franziska Oesterlin, to swallow a preparation containing iron and then attached magnets to her legs and stomach to produce within the patient what he called an
artificial tide.
The results were dramatic enough to attract attention, with the previously emaciated Fräulein Franziska regaining a healthy weight and quickly married off. Building on this, Mesmer toured Bavaria, giving exhibitions of his technique and offering his opinion to the Munich Academy of Sciences on the currently much discussed spate of exorcisms being performed by the Austrian priest Johann Gassner, all of which Mesmer explained as a deceptively religious use of, you guessed it, animal magnetism, thus virtually ending Gosner's career and furthering his own. From the following year, 1775, we have a particularly good account of Mesmer's work, as he was invited to the castle of Hungarian nobleman Baron Horecki de Horka, who suffered from a condition which would not respond to care provided even by the foremost doctors of Vienna. Our records come from a diary kept by the family tutor, resident scholar, and interpreter, Herr Seifert, who observed Mesmer keenly, expecting that he was a charlatan. These diaries would later be discovered by the German mystic and healer, Justinus Kerner, and were later reproduced in his 1856 volume, Experiences of Mesmer in Hungary. Upon Mesmer's arrival, Seifert finds the doctor preoccupied with the state of his equipment,
variously shaped artificial magnets, and an electrical machine, which had been broken upon the journey and thereby rendered useless.
Being an amateur scientist himself, and magnets being all the rage, Seifert happens to have some magnets of his own. And he says he
lent him mine, which, although smaller and simpler of construction, nevertheless proved all that was necessary.
Seifert, Kenner says, observes that
Mesmer wore beneath his linen shirt another of leather, lined with silk, and supposes that Mesmer sought by this means to prevent the escape of the magnetic fluid. He believes that Mesmer also wore natural and artificial magnets about his person, with the intention of strengthening the magnetic condition in himself.
The peculiar treatments Mesmer provided the Baron initially did not sit well with the Countess, his wife. She confidentially asked Seifert to write to another doctor on her behalf, but before doing so, she suggests he observe firsthand what is going on. Seifert records the weird scene.
Mesmer sat at the right side of the bed upon a chair, with his left arm turned towards the bed. He wore a gray gown trimmed with gold lace, and upon one leg a white silk stocking. His other foot, naked, was placed in a wooden washtub, about 2 feet in diameter and filled with water. Whether the water was hot or cold, or whether it contained magnets, I did not observe. By the side of this tub sat the violinist, Koloretic, with his face turned towards the bed. Koloretic was completely dressed, but held in his hand a walking stick, which was placed with its iron-sheathed tip in the tub of water. This cane he held with his right hand and rubbed incessantly from the top downwards.
Seifert proposes that these weird actions were intended to produce static electricity, presumably something of therapeutic value. Then he continues,
both these personages were silent. It was only the Baron who spoke, whilst he lay in bed, covered alone with his fur coat, made of wolves' skins.
Later,
curiosity led me again to the chamber of the sick man. Everything there remained unchanged. There was no end to the delirious talk, the curses, the lamentations, and the whimperings of the poor Baron. Frequently he besought us to shoot him dead outright. We, none of us, were in a comfortable state of mind. Mesmer alone appeared grave and thoughtful. When the crisis of the disease appeared to Mesmer to have reached a sufficient height, he left hold of the Baron's hand, and in place of his hand caught hold of him by the foot when the violence of the paroxysms abated. We imagined that the whole was over, when suddenly Mesmer seized the Baron by his hand once more, and the paroxysms returned. For some time he thus exchanged his hold upon the Baron, with the results ever the same in their alternation.
For at least another day or so, the process continues amid the Countess's protestations, which are met by Mesmer's calm insistence that a cure is imminent. At length, the doctor emerges from the bedchamber, leading the Baron into the presence of the Countess,
who is greatly delighted once more to behold her husband, apparently again in his usual health.
As word got out about the activities in the castle, visitors streamed in, and Zeifert documents the peculiar variety of techniques employed. When a peasant comes complaining of pains in his stomach,
Mesmer examined the tumor and then ordered the peasant to readjust his clothes and pointed, as was his custom from time to time, with his finger towards the affected part. He treated the peasant so far in a manner different to his other magnetic patients that he placed him quite separated from them upon a chair and gave him a large square wine bottle filled with water to hold carefully upon his stomach. This bottle, Mesmer had previously held in his own hands in order to magnetize its contents. Nothing especially curious in relation to this man's case did I observe, until Mesmer one day, whilst in the anteroom, the door of which was shut, and began charging the electrifying machine. Suddenly, the peasant let fly the coarsest oaths against Mesmer. I questioned him why he allowed himself to be thus carried away, when the man excused himself by saying that he was experiencing such prickings as could only come from that German man or the devil. Smiling at the peasant's simplicity, I entered the antechamber, where I found that Mesmer, in the presence of various spectators, was attracting the sparks out of the electrical machines by the knuckles of his hand. At each repetition of the experiment, the peasant, sighing and compressing his teeth together, as I could both hear and see as I did, with one foot in the antechamber, the other within the hall.
Mesmer's pointing cures are frequently mentioned. Another villager arrives in a debilitated state and...
Mesmer, having inquired after the seat of the complaint, pointed with his finger towards the man's chest, standing at some little distance.
The patient then exhibits...
a strong convulsion in the presence of many witnesses and vomited a considerable quantity of matter.
A year later, Zeifert encounters the robust-looking man in the street and is begged to thank Mesmer on his behalf for the cure. In another incident, Mesmer points to the reflection of a man who is standing in another room at the time. Despite being unaware, unable to see Mesmer's actions, the man, Zeifert says,
was seized with convulsive movements, and the others who were in connection with him, though holding each other's hands, were each one affected according to his or her nature.
This idea of a therapeutic magnetic fluid passing like an electrical current through interlocked hands becomes more prominent as Mesmer drew increasingly large numbers of enthusiasts seeking treatment and is mentioned with particular frequency in the context of his later years in Paris. But back to Vienna. Shortly after his return from Hungary, Mesmer accepted an invitation to treat the blindness of an 18-year-old woman by the name of Maria Paradis. This would be a pivotal episode for Mesmer, not only because of the dire condition to be treated, but because of the young woman's peculiar status. She was the daughter of a personal secretary to Emperor Francis I and goddaughter to the Empress. Beyond that, and despite her blindness, she was a pianist and singer of some renown and regarded as a protege by the Empress, who provided her with a stipend to further her musical studies. Paradis performed within influential Viennese circles. She was acquainted with Haydn, Gluck, Salieri, and Mozart, who's thought to have written for her his Piano Concerto No. 18 in B-flat major. She also composed herself 5 operas and 3 cantatas using a notation system of her own invention, something involving pegs of diverse sizes placed in a board representing musical staves, all of which would be later transcribed by copyists. Her blindness was said to have begun at the age of 3 with a convulsive twitching in the eyes and resulted in the girl being subjected to all manner of misguided medical procedures, including encasing her head in plaster for an entire week, as well as the application of electricity to her eyes. The idea of treatments involving subtle energies and Mesmer's gentle hand-waving would hardly have seemed a risky proposition after all this. We know his treatments went on for a year and some months, so there must have been something positive about the German doctor's approach. In fact, Mesmer claimed to have relieved Maria's blindness to the extent that she could make out certain objects, though allegedly had trouble interpreting what these were. However, this was flatly denied by Josef Barth, a professor at the University of Vienna who occupied the first department of ophthalmology established in Europe. He'd previously consulted on Maria's case, and it's been suggested there might have been a certain competitive bias involved in his assessment. At least, this is what Mesmer said. Skeptics, however, believe that Paradis feigned visual competence to please Mesmer, or even that there was a romantic relationship between the two, as Mesmer had insisted on her taking up residence in his home for over a year during the course of treatments. Others have suggested that Maria's blindness was merely a hysterical condition, one perhaps responsive to Mesmer's gentle approach, or that Mesmer's success was ultimately denied by her parents, who feared the loss of the stipend dependent on her disability. Whatever happened, we don't know, but Mesmer's standing within the better circles of Vienna seems to have been compromised, and shortly thereafter, in 1777, he relocated to Paris, and Marie Paradis spent the rest of her life in blindness. Apparently, it was more name recognition than any sordid particulars that followed Mesmer to Paris, where his practice rapidly expanded. To accommodate the throngs, he used a scaled-up version of the tub mentioned earlier, the multi-person baquet or tub, described by a Scottish physician, John Grieve, in a 1784 letter to a fellow doctor, Joseph Black. After some speculation regarding the profitability of Mesmer's racket, Grieve comments that the treatment facility set up by the German doctor is
so much crowded that there are seldom fewer than 200 people in it at one time, from morning to night.
And he goes on.
In the middle of the room is placed a vessel, about a foot and a half high, which is called here a baquet. It is so large that 20 people can easily sit round it, near the edge of the lid which covers it, their holes pierced, corresponding to the number of persons who are to surround it. Into these holes are introduced iron rods, bent at right angles outwards, and of different heights, so as to answer to the part of the body to which they are to be applied. Besides these rods, there is a rope which communicates between the baquet and one of the patients, and from him it is carried to another, and so on the whole round. The most sensible effects are produced on the approach of Mesmer, who is said to convey the fluid by certain motions of his hands or eyes, without touching the person. I have talked with several who have witnessed these effects and who have convulsions occasioned and removed by a movement of his hand.
While Mesmer's magnetic salons, as they were called, exerted a faddish appeal, it was more difficult for him to find acceptance within the Royal Academy of Science or the Royal Society of Medicine. In 1784, 7 years after his arrival in the city, Louis XVI called for a commission to investigate this controversial new science, something initiated without Mesmer's knowledge or involvement. It was Charles de Nicolas de Lens, a personal physician to the king's brother and disgruntled former associate of Mesmer, who was chosen to participate in this study. Persons sitting on the committee included the American ambassador and scientist Benjamin Franklin, the chemist Antoine Lavoisier, and Joseph Guillotin, that tireless promoter of a humane instrument of jurisprudence which in no way was abused during the revolution to come. That is, more anglicized, Joseph Guillotin. As you might have guessed, things did not go particularly well for Mesmer. It was not a criminal investigation, of course, but the details of actual mesmeric practice seemed to fly in the face of the Enlightenment spirit. Descriptions of magnetic therapy appearing in the report sounded more like some species of madness.
The patients present a very varied picture by the different states in which they are. Some are calm, quiet, and feel nothing. Others cough, spit, feel some slight pain, a local or general heat and sweat. Others are agitated and tormented by convulsions. These convulsions are extraordinary in their number, duration, and violence. As soon as one convulsion begins, several others manifest themselves. The commissioners have seen some that lasted 3 hours. They are accompanied by expectorations of a cloudy and viscous water caused by the violence of the efforts. Sometimes streaks of blood have been seen, and among others, there is a young male patient who often throws it up in abundance. These convulsions are characterized by rapid, involuntary movements of all the limbs and of the whole body, by tightening of the throat, jerking movements, wildness and confusion in the eyes, piercing shrieks, tears, hiccuping, and immoderate laughter. They are preceded or followed by a state of languor and dreaminess, a sort of prostration and even drowsiness.
Aside from the aesthetic distaste these spectacles would have generated, there were the scientific findings. After conducting double-blind studies on subjects who had been magnetized and those who had not, the commission ultimately concluded that any effects experienced could simply be chalked up to
imagination.
After the report was issued, the faddish enthusiasm with which Mesmer had been greeted turned as quickly to skepticism. He left the city seeking greener pastures elsewhere in France, Germany, Austria, and Great Britain, never staying anywhere that long, but eventually settling in Switzerland, where he practiced for a few years, and then retiring to his birthplace in Meersburg, Germany. By 1789, Mesmer had become a figure suited to slapstick parody. First produced that year, Mozart's opera Così fan tutte, roughly translated as Women Are Like That, is a comic romp involving the swapping of fiancés and assumed identities, including a character disguised as a mesmerist who sings.
This is a famous piece of magnet, the mesmeric stone, which had its origin in Germany and then became celebrated in France.
The pretend doctor, a helpful maid in disguise, has been called to treat two other disguised characters who have drunk a pretend poison. The magnet is presented as a ridiculously oversized prop, and there's lots of cartoonish twitching and convulsing by the patients, not in response to the poison, but in imitation of Mesmer's gullible patients. Of course, playful references to mesmerism were frequent in popular art of the day, in plays, newspaper journals, and broadsheets. The opera is only worth mention because Mesmer had been friends with the Mozart family. His marriage to the wealthy heiress not only allowed him to purchase a large estate with beautiful gardens, but also to move in these elite circles, as well as patronize the arts, including the work of a young Wolfgang. Because of the age difference, Mesmer was 22 years older than the young Mozart. It was more the boy's father, Leopold, with whom he was friendly, but he's said to have invited the child prodigy to present his opera, Bastien und Bastien, composed when the boy was 12, in a private theater on the Mesmer estate. The offer being made when other venues had refused it on the grounds that it could not possibly have been written by a child of that age. We don't, however, know if it was ever performed there. There are a couple documents confirming this Mesmer-Mozart connection, including a 1773 letter Leopold wrote to his wife in Salzburg, remarking,
"The Mesmers are all well and in good form as usual. Herr von Mesmer, at whose house we lunched on Monday, played for us on Miss Davies' harmonica, or glass instrument, and played very well. It cost him about 50 ducats, and is very beautifully made."
You're hearing Adagio for Glass Harmonica, a composition by Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus, that is. Invented in 1761 by Ben Franklin, the glass harmonica is a strange instrument, a more permanent and portable version of an earlier instrument or contrivance called a glass harp. That is an arrangement of partially filled glasses played with a wetted finger run along the rim with different volumes of water producing the varied tones. Franklin's invention, originally called a glass harmonica, an Italianized version of harmonica, no H, or even a glass harmonium, used glass bowls of descending size mounted on a horizontal spindle, rotated like a spinning wheel by a foot treadle. The importance of the glass harmonica to Mesmer is well documented in the 1814 book Mesmerism, written by Carl Christian Wolfart, a magnetic physician himself who spent a month with Mesmer not long before his death. In it, he remarks on the doctor's use of music as an adjunct to his therapy, music that Mesmer himself played. A long performance on a cello used to induce sleep, he says,
Mesmer was accustomed to make use of the tones of a glass harmonica, with beneficial effects as a bearer of the magnetic fluid in cases of magnetic cure.
Beyond this, however, Mesmer had a strong personal connection to the instrument. Wolfart writes,
Mesmer was accustomed, when supper was over, after a little repose, and when twilight was gathered, to play upon his beloved harmonica, when all around and within him seemed harmonious. As his playing became more and more animated, and the tones drawn forth by his hand became more intense, he would accompany the music with his voice, singing in a low tone and guiding his fingers by the modulation of his voice, which even now in old age was very agreeable. Thus his soul entered into the music, and such a harmony of the spheres as was this music, I have never since heard.
However, the unearthly sounds produced by this peculiar instrument were also a source of unease in some quarters. It was feared that its tones could unsettle the brain, provoke melancholia, or provide a medium through which unwelcome spirits might enter. Legends became attached to those known to perform on the instrument. Marianne Davies, the performer mentioned in Leopold Mozart's letter, a British musician originally recruited by Franklin to showcase his instrument, who also toured Europe with a glass harmonica of her own and even provided lessons on the instrument to a young Marie Antoinette, was said to have been afflicted with melancholia and other nervous disorders. The German musician Marianne Kirchgesner, for whom Mozart composed a few pieces, was another touring harmonicist who, oddly, like Marie Paradis, happened to be blind, left without sight after a case of smallpox at the age of 4. It was widely reported that her musical career had ended with her death in an asylum, though in fact she died of fever contracted after her touring carriage plummeted into a ravine. She was only 39, so perhaps rather unlucky, if not insane. Fears of the glass harmonica seem to have been particularly strong in Germany. The Ghost Call, a story about a haunted glass harmonica played by a phantom hand, was included in a volume of ghost stories by Johann August Appel, the German author whose works were read by Byron and the Shelleys on that June night in Italy that inspired the novels Frankenstein and Dracula. And the German critic J. L. Röhlig, in an 1804 pamphlet on the harmonica, asserted that the instrument could
make women faint, send a dog into convulsions, make a sleeping girl wake screaming through a chord of the diminished seventh, and even cause the death of one very young.
But I probably shouldn't have you listening to the glass harmonicas so much, so let's get back to mesmerism and a final note on Mesmer's last days. While I've clarified that the term animal magnetism wasn't used in reference to our feathered or four-legged friends, there were attempts to manipulate members of the animal kingdom using these mysterious energies. In the 1840s, the French mesmerist Charles Lafontaine gave a highly publicized presentation at the London Zoo, during which he was said to have hypnotized a lion. And in 1883, an entire book dedicated to the subject was published, Trials of Animal Magnetism on the Brute Creation, in which the author, one John Wilson, documents his efforts to mesmerize various cats, dogs, hens, goats, ducks, geese, a macaw, and even some fish caught in a nearby river. Mesmer himself, according to Wolfhard's 1814 volume,
perhaps through his powerful magnetic influence, possessed the faculty of taming and attracting animals towards himself.
Wolfhard goes on to describe a canary that kept the doctor company to his very end.
Its abode being an open cage in Mesmer's chamber. Every morning early, the bird would fly forth, perch upon Mesmer's head whilst he slept, and wake him with its song. Nor would the bird allow his friend any peace until he rose, dressed, and placed himself at the breakfast table. So long as Mesmer drank his coffee, the bird remained perched upon the sugar basin and pecked the sugar. If Mesmer hesitated to drop a lump of sugar into his cup, the little creature, remarking the hesitation, would drop the lump of sugar. When his master arose from the breakfast table, the little canary would fly back into its cage. A slight stroke from Mesmer's hand would throw the bird into a sleep as though it were dead, whilst a stroke, the reverse way of the feathers, would awaken it. Mesmer was, like his bird, accustomed to retire early to rest, usually about the hour of 8. Whilst he prepared for sleep, the bird would thrust its head beneath its wing.
On March 5th, 1815, as Mesmer felt his end approaching, he called for his friend, a young priest, Father Fessler, hoping that he might
play to him upon the harmonica whilst he departed. Before his friend arrived, however, Mesmer, smiling, fell asleep forever in this world, seemingly filled with a presentiment of an unending, all-musical divine harmony awaiting his soul beyond the grave. As if still alive, the body lay untouched till the morning, but the canary did not, as usual, fly forth from its cage to perch upon his head to awaken him. The bird neither sang nor ate any more, and very shortly afterwards was found dead in its cage. I hope everyone's been enjoying our show, and if so, that you'd leave us a review to boost our visibility. We've added a link to walk you through that process on our website. You can find it via the reviews menu, or even better, join us on Patreon as a supporter. Among the many reward tiers available, a monthly pledge of $2 provides you immediate access to posts on our show blog, in which I share
curious tidbits from history, folklore, and films related to our general subject matter. Donating a mere $4 or more monthly brings you an extra episode every month, one similar to what you've just heard, but a bit shorter. I should also mention that when you access the blog and bonus episodes, it's not just the material from the current month we're talking about. There's a long archive stretching back to 2018 with content you can immediately enjoy. Other rewards include downloads of those show soundscapes heard under the narration, the show scripts, my Krampus book, various t-shirt and mug options, and unique hand-packed mystery kits. Pledges start at $1 a month and can be canceled at any time. And here are some of those heroic souls who've recently signed up and to whom we are very grateful. Thank yous to a UK listener, Kaz Catlin, and a Krampus aficionado, Jennifer Fonseca, and to new listener, Willis Goldbeck. Bone and Sickle is written and produced by me, Al Reidenauer. Mrs. Carswell is played by Sarah Chavez, whose book, We Need to Talk About Death, can be found on Amazon and in stores near you. Thanks so much for listening.